Welcome to another episode of Profiles in Leadership. I am your host, Steve Anderson, and today our guest is T.R. Reid. T.R. Reid has become one of the nation's best-known reporters through his books and articles, his documentary films, his reporting for the Washington Post, and his lighthearted commentaries on NPR's Morning Edition. Reid majored in the classics at Princeton University and subsequently worked as a naval officer during the Vietnam War, a lawyer, a teacher, and assorted other jobs. At the Washington Post, he covered Congress and four presidential campaigns. He served as the paper's bureau chief in Tokyo and London. Reid has reported from four dozen countries on five continents. T.R. Reid has written 10 books in English and three in Japanese. His 2009 book, The Healing of America, became a national bestseller. PBS Frontline made two documentaries, Sick Around the World and India, A Second Opinion, following Reid as he did the reporting for that book. T.R. Reid's newest book, A Fine Mess, A Global Quest for a Fairer, Simpler, and More Efficient Tax Code, has recently been published in paperback. It suggests what the U.S. should and should not do at reforming our rotten federal tax system. Mr. Reid has made documentary films for National Geographic Television, PBS, and the A&E Network. His latest PBS film was U.S. Healthcare, The Good News, which is being broadcast by PBS affiliates around the country. Reid is chair of the board of the Colorado Coalition for the Homeless, a $70 million operation that serves tens of thousands of Coloradans. He is the chairman of the Colorado Foundation for Universal Healthcare, the statewide citizens campaign working for universal healthcare coverage. He has served on the boards of Princeton University and several other community and national organizations. Welcome to the show, T.R. I really appreciate you being here today.
Hi, Steve. Great to be on your air.
You know, you've been a journalist for five decades, I believe. If you were just starting your career today, would you choose journalism again?
I would. Yeah, I think it's really fun work. If you're a curious person, if you're the kind of person who likes to tell stories, it's a great line of work. And I personally like writing. It's always kind of thrilled me that people pay me to write because I like doing it anyway. So, yeah, I think I'd become a reporter again. Although I have to say, I have three kids who watched me around the world being a reporter, and none of them became a reporter. So maybe they saw something. I don't know.
So what's your take on the attacks on the media today that we currently see?
Really galls me. A free press is crucial to a democracy. We have to know what's going on if we're going to govern ourselves. And you know what really ticks me off is Donald Trump calling me, a reporter, the enemy of the people. And the reason I say that is I'm the same age as Donald Trump. We both finished college when our country was at war in Vietnam. And millions of guys our age, including me, signed up, put on a uniform, and served our country in the armed forces. Donald Trump had his daddy pay a doctor to say he had bone spurs and unfortunately was too weak to serve our country. And now that draft dodger calls me an enemy of the people. And, you know, after the war, I went to work for the Washington Post. And the Washington Post newsroom was full of veterans. Ben Bradley, Bob Woodward, both Navy veterans. We had so many Navy men in the Washington Post newsroom, we said we could man the bridge of a battleship just with Post reporters. So it galls me that this draft dodger calls me the enemy of the people when our country needed us. I stepped up. He ducked out.
You know, as the 2020 presidential campaign heats up, do you think all the talk on the Medicare for All addresses your views on universal health care?
Well, I think we need to provide health care for everybody. I think Medicare for All is a way to do it. It may not, it's not the only way. There are a lot of ways to get there. And the problem is Medicare for All has been portrayed as socialist or very expensive or hopeless. And its advocates, I don't think, are doing a very good job of defending it. So to the extent it sets back the push for universal health care, I don't think it's helpful. I think the Democrats are certain to nominate somebody who will be for providing health care for everybody. Of course, Barack Obama promised that too and didn't get there. It's way past time for our country to provide health care for everybody. We spend twice as much as any other country for health care, and get a lot less. We've got to fix the system. And I am kind of hopeful that the 2020 election will be a big step toward getting us there. But I'm not sure that Medicare for All is the way to do it.
So could you just describe for our listeners what you think the difference is between the Medicare for All plans that we hear and universal health care, which you've supported for some time?
Well, universal health care means making sure that everybody has access to a doctor when they're sick or injured. At the moment, there are about 30 or 30.5 million Americans with no health insurance. When they get really sick or when they get in a car wreck, well, then their doctor's office is the emergency room. We do treat them in the most expensive possible way. But if one of those people just has kind of a dull ache on the right side of their abdomen, they work through it because they can't afford to go to the doctor. And, of course, 3 months later, they're in the emergency room with a ruptured appendix, which we could have fixed probably with treatment 3 months earlier. So getting everybody access to health care when they're sick or injured is the test. And Medicare would be a good way to do it. It would be cheaper than what we're spending now. But there are other routes. Germany, for example, provides health care for everybody with private doctors, private hospitals, and private insurance. Everybody in Germany is required to buy insurance from a private insurance company, and your employer helps you pay the premium, just like here. That's one way to do it. Some other countries, Great Britain, for example, the hospitals, the labs, the nurses, the doctors are government employees, and it's all paid for through taxes. It's not free. Healthcare is never free, but you don't get a bill. You pay for it through taxes. Other countries have a Medicare kind of system where the doctors and hospitals are private and the insurance plan is public. So there are different routes to get there, Steve, but the most important thing is commit to cover everybody. And if you make that commitment, doggone it, we're a rich, decent country. If my neighbor is sick, I'm going to see that she gets health care. If we make that commitment, then we can come up with a method to get there.
You know, some have come up with the idea that really the only way to get control over these healthcare costs is to reduce or limit the income of healthcare providers. And isn't all the big money in healthcare really going towards the insurance and pharma companies? What's your take on that? Do you think that healthcare providers can continue to be high earners in our system, or does that have to change?
Yeah, healthcare providers, they have put in years and years of training and work. They provide a valuable service. They should be well paid. And in every country, they're decently paid. I don't think cutting healthcare providers' pay is the answer to our healthcare problem. The real costs are the huge administrative costs piled on by our fragmented system. The American insurance industry adds about 20% to every doctor bill. It's like a 20% tax on every bill. We could cut those costs and still pay doctors and hospitals a decent amount of money. Plus, Steve, one of the most lucrative jobs in America these days is hospital administrator. I was on a board at the American Hospital Association. The other members were mostly hospital CEOs, really decent, hardworking people, and they made $6, $8, $10 million a year running a hospital called Sisters of Mercy or something like that. So there's a lot of administrative costs that we could pare down and that other countries have pared.
You know, it's interesting. I realize that Cuba would be an extreme example. Because they're a communist country. But when I visited there not too long ago, our guide informed us that you would be surprised to see how many neurosurgeons are driving taxis in Havana because they can make more money doing that than they can what the government will pay them to do surgery. So, the reason I bring it up is, do we risk chasing the best and the brightest out of healthcare with these types of income and financial pressures?
Well, I don't think so, because maybe some people go through medical training because they want to get rich, but I think most people who do some kind of medical nursing PT training do it because, A, they were good in science, and they want to help people. They want to use their skill and their energy to help people. And, you know, when you talk to doctors or nurses or PTs, they don't talk about their cabin in Florida or something. They talk about somebody who walked out of the office feeling better because of their treatment. So I think that's what motivates doctors. Yeah, they deserve, I mean, they put a lot of work in. They deserve decent pay. There's no question about that. And it's a prestigious line of work. People respect Medicare medical providers. But I don't think they're doing it for the pay. I don't know. You're one of them. Is that what people do it for?
No, I think you're right on. I think that that's definitely an afterthought. And I think it's changed a lot, too. I think maybe in the 80s and 90s, it was more of a status type of position that when you got there, may give some guarantees of a higher lifestyle than others. But in the long run, I do think people do things because they want to help people and want to help humanity, and that attracts a certain type of person. And I think that continues to this day. So
I was in when I was in Japan, I was talking to a doctor. He had a 19-bed hospital. And he was a middle-class person. He wasn't starving or anything. He was doing fine. But he said, he'd been running this hospital for about 26, 27 years. He said if he'd gone to work for Toyota as a junior executive, he'd be making more today as a mid-level executive at Toyota than he was as a doctor running his family hospital. And so why do you do it? And he said, well, I'm helping people. And in Japan, it's very prestigious. He says, when the woman calls her mom and says, Mom, I've met a wonderful guy and I'm going to marry him. He's a very nice guy. And by the way, Hiroshi is a doctor. Well, that's like calling mom and saying, Mom, my boyfriend went to Harvard. It's just very prestigious. It makes everybody proud to be involved. So I think that's a key motivator.
Yeah. Since this is a podcast about leadership, who needs to be the lead for healthcare change? Is it journalists like yourself? Is it politicians? Is it the government, healthcare providers, or the citizens of this country? Who needs to lead this reform?
I think we need a politician. We need government leaders to take on this challenge. Doggone it. Let's cover everybody. We're a rich country. Let's provide health care for everybody. And in my book, I went around the world looking at how other countries got to health care for all. And in almost every case, you could name one or two people who took up this cudgel and said, doggone it, let's get this done, and convinced others that a decent ethical country ought to provide health care for everybody. We need a leader to do that. I thought Barack Obama was the guy. He ran in 2008 on a promise, I'm going to provide health care for everybody. And I think Obama probably did the best he could get through Congress, but he didn't do it. His plan left, when he left office, there were 28 million people without health insurance. Today, there are more. There are about 30 million without health insurance. So we need a leader who says, doggone it, a decent country ought to do this, and I'm going to show us how. I think that's the key.
Yeah. I know that you have covered the opioid crisis in your writings and your speeches. How did we get here, and how do we reverse this epidemic, in your opinion?
How to reverse it is harder. How we got there, I think, was good intentions that went wrong. I think, people come in pain. I have a very good friend who's a pain specialist, and people come into his office in severe pain. And he was convinced that these pills really helped, that he could help people live a normal life if they just took the pill. There were studies at the time promoted by the big pharma, by the industry, saying they're not dangerous, they're not habit-forming. And I think there was just people hoped for the best, and it didn't happen. Now I think, I don't know the answer, I'm not a doctor, but I think the answer is we have to help people deal with pain in non-pharmaceutical ways, or at least non-narcotic ways. And that's probably doable.
As a media correspondent, you covered four different presidential campaigns and have observed several others. What leadership style works in this country, and where do you think we're headed in the future as far as leadership for this country?
Well, the winners are people who figured out what really was on people's mind, what people really needed. Like Jimmy Carter I don't think was a very good president, but he was a great candidate because he ran right after Watergate, and he figured out that what the American people really wanted was decency. They wanted an honest, hardworking peanut farmer kind of guy to be their leader because we had suffered so under Nixon and Watergate. He figured that out. And then he didn't turn out to be a very good president, and Reagan figured out that what people really needed was a reliable person they liked who could make things work. And he offered that style of leadership. And then Trump in 2016 figured out, he sensed that a lot of people were really angry that their life had not improved since the Great Recession, that government and our leadership was not working for them. And he took advantage of that anger and kind of squirmed his way into the presidency by a tiny margin. So successful leaders are the ones who figure out what American people are looking for and then offer that.
You know, and you've spent a lot of time overseas and done a lot of reporting overseas. Is there someone that you can think of in other countries that you thought was a great leader that maybe the American people aren't aware of?
Aren't aware of? Let me think. Yeah, there was a guy in Japan named Toshi Kaifu who took over in Japan right when the bubble era ended and they entered a severe recession. And I think he did a pretty serious job of leading his country through. He installed a sales tax, which they needed to balance their budget, even though it was unpopular. So he was a guy who saw where the country needed to go, and he did it. And incidentally, he lost the next election because it wasn't a popular thing to do. So, and then I was in Britain during the most of Tony Blair's era, and he was phenomenal. People were very fed up with the Conservative Party. It wasn't doing much. It was corrupt. It had a lot of corrupt charges, and Blair came along and took a leftist party, almost socialist party, and pulled it to the center and said, people want an alternative to the Tories, but they don't want to go really far left. I thought Blair was a good leader and a smart, articulate guy, but he decided that his role in life as America's greatest ally was to be a friend of the President of the United States, no matter what he did. He was a very close friend of Bill Clinton, and that made sense to me. Both Blair and Clinton were, you know, left-wing lawyers who pulled a left-wing party to the center to get elected. They were the same guy. And then while I was in Britain, George W. Bush was elected president, and I went over to Downing Street, and I said to Blair, I can see how you get along with your fellow lawyer, Bill Clinton, but here's a Texas oil man. Can you get along with Bush? And Blair said to me, I guarantee you I will be George W. Bush's best friend in the world, because he thought that was the job of the British prime minister, was to be friendly with the U.S. And then he backed Bush in Iraq, and that ruined his career in Britain. It was so unpopular. But until that point, I thought he was a really good, effective leader. And Britain did very well under Blair's leadership, in my view.
You know, it's we're all aware that we're so partisan now in this country when it comes to politics. Is there a chance that we can get back to the more moderate centrist position and speak to more of the greater majority of people? Or are we just headed down this polarized, you know, you're either left or you're right, and there's nothing in the middle?
No, we have a chance. I think we'll come back. Nobody's happy with this kind of polarization. We can see it's not working for us. So I compare it to the situation in about 1979 and early 1980. This was the end of Jimmy Carter's first term. Americans were really sour. You know, there's this polling question, is America on the right track or the wrong track? The wrong track answer was about 88%. I mean, Americans really felt badly about our country and where we stood. Interest rates were high. Inflation was high. Things were just not good. Jimmy Carter said we were bound up in malaise, which was not a very good thing to say. But America was really an unhappy country in 79. Guess what? Ronald Reagan became president in 1984. It was morning in America. We felt great about ourselves. The guy won 48 states. So a leader can turn things around. And I think if we get the right leader, we will become a unified, non-polarized country again. I definitely think it can happen.
Yeah, that's great. In your latest book, A Fine Mess, you discuss taxation in America compared to other countries. Is the tax bill that was recently passed in the Senate, is that good for Americans?
No, it didn't really solve the basic problems. It gave everybody, or just almost everybody, a tax break for several years. It lasts until 2025, unless they change it. It gave the biggest breaks to richest people and corporations. Well, okay, that's the Republican approach to policy. That's what they wanted to do. That's what they did. What it didn't do is it didn't deal with the unfairness and the huge complexity of our tax code. Our tax code is ridiculously complicated. It's the most complicated in the world. You know, according to the IRS, an average American family at the median income, about $59,000 for a family of four, spends about 18 hours gathering and maintaining the records, and then about $260 paying for software or for a preparer, $260 just to figure out how much you owe the government. It takes hours. It takes money to pay your taxes. In other countries, in the Netherlands, to pay your federal and provincial taxes takes 15 minutes. In Britain, it takes about 5 minutes. Other countries have found a way to collect the money and make it simple. Nobody else has to pay a preparer. There's no H&R Block in any other rich country. That's only an American thing. So we could definitely make our tax code vastly simpler. The 2017 Tax Reform Act, so-called Reform Act, made it more complicated. It made it worse. So I don't think it solved the fundamental problems. And also, if you just look at the basic job of a tax code is to fund the government, well, our government is running $1 trillion, spending $1 trillion more than it takes in. It's not funding government, so it's not even performing its basic role. So no, our tax code has a lot of problems. Many other countries have done it more simply and more fairly. And that's the argument on my book. If we looked at what these other countries could do, we could do better.
And so what, I realize there's a whole book to tell us that, but in a nutshell, how do you get there? Are you a kind of a flat tax type of guy, or do you just think that we need to just decrease the complexity, and how do you do that?
Yeah, no, the flat tax where everybody pays the same rate, that doesn't help at all, because the hard part is figuring out what your income, quote, income, unquote, what your taxable income was last year. That's what takes hours and 50 lines of the tax code. Once you get to that point, any piece of software in about 2 seconds can figure out what you owe, what the rate should be. So you don't need a standard rate. You just need a vastly simplified code. Get rid of all the exemptions and deductions and giveaways, and then you can reduce rates. In Japan, for example, nobody has to fill out a tax return. The government, they have all the data. They know how much you earned. They know how much was withheld. They know how much interest you made at the bank. They know how much your mortgage payment was. They fill out the tax return for you, and they send you a copy of it. And if it looks right, and it's always right, you just check okay, and you're done. It takes 30 seconds to pay your taxes, file your tax return. If you don't like what the government did, you have the right to fill out your own form if you want to, but hardly anybody does. And I have a friend in Japan, Togo, who did some reporting for me on my book. I asked him, hey, tell me how the Japan tax system works. And he says, what do you mean? I get a card from the government. It says, you owe this much. We're going to take it out of your bank account on April 1st, and I'm done. And I said, gee, Togo, in America, people spend hours and hours filling out forms and gathering documents and making calculations to pay their taxes. And Togo says to me, gee, why would anybody want to do that?
that's a good question.
Nobody would.
Right.
So we could learn from those other countries. And incidentally, this idea, the IRS could fill out every line on the tax return for about 70% of American families. They know how much income you made. They know how much tax was withheld. They know, you know, how much interest you paid, et cetera, your state tax deduction. They know all that. They could fill out the form. And this is proposed in Congress every year. Let's have the IRS fill out the return. If you like it, you're done. If you don't like it, you can do your own. And when this is proposed in Congress, guess what? H&R Block lobbies against it, right? We do more work, they make more money. So we could definitely fix this if we learn from other countries. That's my argument.
Yeah, it's just, and is there, would Americans embrace that? It almost, there's a bit of a privacy piece there, or a bit of, you know, oh my gosh, my government's telling me what I have to do, which Americans tend to resist sometimes, yet the information's there, so what privacy do you have, I suppose?
I understand. You don't have privacy on your income. The government knows how much income you made because your employer is required by law to report it. The government knows how much you withheld. So I don't see a privacy issue. Either you report it to the IRS or the IRS writes it down itself. They already know. I don't see what the argument against it would be, because if you want to fill out your own return, you can. The fact is, nobody would. Why would you want to spend all that time? The IRS has they have many different notices and letters they send to taxpayers, but about 28 million times a year, they send out a notice called a CP2000 notice. This is not an audit. This is a correction. And what it says is, I get it many times. I get it many years. It says, on line 39, you entered $4,300. It should have been $4,826. And I get this, and I say, well, geez, if they knew that already, why did I spend hours trying to figure out what to put on that line? They already knew it. So, you know, let them fill out my return for me. If I don't like it, I don't have to. Anyway, this, many countries do it this way. In Britain, the Internal Revenue sends you a letter at the end of March and says, we think you earned this much. We know we withheld this much. We think you owe this much more tax, or we owe you a refund. And, you know, if the letter looks right, it's done. You're done. It took, 1 minute to pay your taxes.
Yeah, makes a lot of sense.
We ought to do that, I think.
Yeah. So, getting back to the leadership side of things here, you brought up Tony Blair as someone you admire as a politician. What about in the world of business? Is there anyone that you've seen over your time as a reporter and a journalist that you just think really was a great leader in our society?
A great leader that I worked for in the U.S. Navy was Admiral Rickover. Admiral Rickover was the guy who invented the nuclear propulsion for Navy ships. He was the first guy to put a nuclear reactor on a submarine and drive it around the world underwater, without any fuel or anything. And when I was in the Navy, I was assigned to Admiral Rickover's Naval Reactors Unit for 4.5 years. I served on a nuclear sub, and then I was sent to Washington to work for Rickover. God, he was a great leader. And the reason was, he convinced all of us that we had a great crusade. We had a great historic mission, and that was dragging the U.S. Navy into the 21st century. In the 19th century, the U.S. Navy resisted steamships. They wanted to stick to sail, even though other navies were going to steamships. And in the same way, in the 20th century, the U.S. Navy resisted going to nuclear power. They wanted to continue burning diesel fuel on their ships. And we felt we had this huge crusade to bring the U.S. Navy into the modern world. And he convinced all of us that what we were doing was the most important work in the world. What a leader. He was a great leader. And he made us work 6 days a week. We had to come in Saturday. And I got pretty friendly with Admiral Rickover, and I complained to him about it once. I said, I got a wife and family. I want to be home on Saturday. He said, hey, I'm 70 years old. I'm in here Sunday. You know, he was really an inspiring leader. So he was good. And then guess what? I then went to work as a reporter for the Washington Post. Our leader was the great editor, Ben Bradley, the Watergate editor. He did the same thing. He convinced us that reporting for the Washington Post was the most important work in the world. He says, you can't trust those bastards in Washington. You can't trust those guys. They'll cheat you in a minute. somebody's got to keep them honest, and that's our job. And boy, did I believe that, you know. Yeah, boy, there's no more important, no more valuable job than the one I'm doing. I'm going to be in here Sunday morning working on my... So, you know, in both of those cases, they were leaders who convinced us that our work really mattered for the good of the world. And, you know, it made it fun to go to work.
Yeah, that's interesting. As we're sitting here talking with your talk about the submarines, my home on Hood Canal, Washington, as I'm interviewing right now, is about 3 miles north of the Bangor submarine base. So,
Cool.
We see those submarines go by every once in a while, and they're pretty impressive machines, that's for sure.
Yeah.
You know, getting back to healthcare a little bit, in your book on healthcare systems around the world, you acted as a patient, I believe, for a shoulder injury. And what country and system do you feel, from a patient's perspective, did you receive the best care, and which country did you experience the worst care?
I got decent care in almost all the rich countries, other than Britain. I'll explain that in a minute. I think I was most impressed in Japan for this reason. When I was in Japan, I had this bum shoulder that I wrecked in the U.S. Navy. I broke it in the U.S. Navy, and it was repaired at Bethesda Naval Hospital in 1972 with a procedure called a Bristow procedure, where they screw your shoulder together with a stainless steel screw. That is not the technique that would be used today. Nobody would use it today, but it was the definitive way to do it in 72. And over time, it got stiff, and that screw got loose, and my shoulder just tightened up. So I went around the world asking people, what would you do for my shoulder? What should I do? And I was most impressed in Japan. I said to somebody, I have this bum shoulder. I need to see an orthopedic surgeon. And this guy recommended probably the most respected orthopedic surgeon in all of Japan. He was at Keio University Hospital. And I called the office and was in his office 3 days later. I mean, no waiting. And I went in there, and this guy had seen, you know, thousands of shoulders. He knew what he was doing. But what really impressed me was when he palpated and looked at the x-rays and figured out what the problem was, then right in my presence in his office, he went on the internet to see what all the treatments were. He didn't just kind of pull it out of memory to show off to me. He was willing to say, gee, I don't remember everything either. I'm going to take a look. And then in Japan, he offered me many different solutions. He could give me a steroid shot. He could send me to physical therapy. He could replace the shoulder with a modern shoulder. He could give me acupuncture, Chinese herbal medicine. Japan had this vast range of treatments that was covered by their national insurance. So I thought that was very good care. And as a matter of fact, he did give me the steroid shot, which at least helped with the pain for a while. It didn't really solve the problem. So I thought that was good. In France, they offered either physical therapy or surgery for a new shoulder. Germany, they were willing to give me the surgery for a new shoulder if I wanted it. The one place that did nothing was Great Britain. You know, they have the National Health Service. Everybody is covered by the government-run health service. And I liked the NHS. My whole family was on the National Health Service in Britain, and we got good care and didn't have to wait. And as I said, you never get a bill in Britain. It's paid through taxes. Anyway, I was pretty friendly with my family physician in Britain, and I went into him one day and said, look at my shoulder. It hurts, and it doesn't move much. It's kind of frozen. What can you do? And he said, well, I can send you to an orthopedic surgeon. I'll get you a consultation, but he's not going to do anything. And then you come back to me and complain. I can send you to another orthopod, and he's not going to do anything. And the reason is, you're living your life fine. You're a journalist. You don't really need that arm that much. You're living a fine life. We're not going to spend money to fix it up for you because things are fine for you. So his advice was, go home and live with it. That was his treatment. And, you know, it wasn't bad. I mean, okay, so I went home and lived with it. It hurt some, but, you know, not that much. And then I came back to America, and of course the Americans, you know, my orthopedic surgeon in here in Denver where I live, he was all set to cut out my shoulder and put in a piece of titanium, you know, in there. And, but he said, you know, you might also try therapy. So I went to a PT, and that really helped. I mean, that guy gave me exercises. They hurt a little bit at first, but, because of the PT and because I've kind of done continuing PT exercises, my arm still doesn't move very much, but it doesn't hurt. It's fine. So, you know, I think Japan was the most impressive because they had the broadest range of treatments that would be covered by their insurance. Britain was interesting in that they did nothing. They basically said, grin and bear it, which I did. And then in America, it was what, you know, I didn't have the surgery. I had the therapy, and the PT really helped. It was really good. So, you know, they're very obviously different approaches. The key thing is that for all of these, the insurance would cover it. I had insurance. If I had my arm problem and no health insurance, I'd be in trouble.
Yeah. And when you talk about whether you use the language of universal health coverage or Medicare for all, or whatever the term you want to use, you know, sure. Americans, yeah. they, I think a lot of them go to your example of the British system, like, oh, that's terrible. That's where we're headed. So I think we have a lot of education to do to explain, you know, what is the best system and how does it work? And it doesn't mean, you know, it's either all or nothing.
Well, you know, as I said, my family of five Americans used the National Health Service when we were in Britain, and it worked fine for us. You know, we didn't usually, sometimes we had to wait. Generally, you didn't have to wait very long. The care was just as good as in the United States. The range of treatment was somewhat restricted. In Britain, they won't give you an annual physical. They don't think it's worth the money. You know, I'm a man of a certain age, and I said to my doctor in Britain, hey, man my age, I ought to have a test for prostate cancer at my age. He says, no, we're not going to do that. We don't think it's cost effective. And I'm thinking, well, you know, if it finds cancer in my body, it's pretty damn cost effective. But he's thinking about whole populations. As a matter of fact, in America now, too, even the urologists agree that it's not cost effective to give that test to every man. So, We did fine in the NHS. I liked it. One of my daughters, Steve, constantly had otitis media earaches, and she would wake up with an earache pretty bad, and we would call the doctor, and you know, 3-4 hours later, that doctor would be at our house, and she would look at Willa's ear and say, "Oh, I believe a penicillin jab is required," and she'd give her the jab, the shot. And then she'd walk out the door. No bill, no copay, no deductible, no paper, no nothing. You know, for me as a dad, that was, as a patient, that was good health care. So it worked for us. On the other hand, my wife, we were skiing in France, and my wife wrecked her knee. And we went into the orthopedic surgeon in Britain, and he said, yeah, I can fix that. I can treat that. And, he said, if you do it on the National Health Service, I can get to it about 3 months from now, maybe. About 3 months you'd have to wait. But you're Americans. You probably have private health insurance. So, you know, if you want to do it privately, come in Saturday. I'll take care of it for you. Because I think that's wrong. They let the same doctor work in the private system and the National Health Service. They shouldn't do that. But that kind of bugged me. But generally, the National Health Service worked fine for us. And if you look overall at overall populations, Britain has slightly better overall health statistics than the U.S., longer life expectancy, better recovery rates from chronic diseases and most injuries than the U.S. has. And they spend about 44% as much per capita on health care, and they cover everybody. So I don't think that's a symbol of a system that's not working. It worked fine for our family.
And when you look at statistics like that that you just mentioned, do you think those statistics are related to the huge numbers of the uninsured in the United States? Is that what drives those type of numbers and those outcomes?
Yes, that's right. If you get American health care, you get good care. I mean, we have the best trained doctors, the best trained therapists, nurses, lab technicians in the world. You get very good care if you get the kind of care America knows how to provide. The reason we rate so low on international rankings is all the people who don't have access to that care, the people who have to wait until they're really sick and go to the emergency room for care. And then they have lower recovery rates from disease or injury. The problem is the reason we rank low on all international rankings of healthcare, it's not our doctors or our therapists. They're great. It's the people who can't get access to that care. That's why we need to provide healthcare for everybody.
And are you hopeful? Do you think that, you know, in your lifetime we're going to see changes? Have you seen changes to date that you think are headed in the right direction? What's your outlook? What's your optimism with the way you think it should be?
I'm hopeful. Yeah, I think we're going to do it. And the reason is, economically, our current system is not sustainable. When I started this work 10 years ago, we were spending about 16.5% of GDP on healthcare. Today, it's over 18%. In 3 or 4 years, we're going to be spending 20%, one of every $5 we spend on healthcare. We just can't afford to keep doing that. Employers can't afford it. The government can't afford it. Patients, people can't afford it. So on economic grounds, we have to change. But the other thing that makes me hopeful, Steve, is Americans always do the right thing eventually. When we realize how cruel our system is, when we realize that people are living in pain, people are not going to work because they're sick, when we realize, as the National Academy of Science tells us, that 22,000 Americans die every year of treatable diseases because they couldn't see a doctor. When you see these stories about people who couldn't afford to buy insulin and died from diabetes, you know, a treatable problem, I think when Americans see that, they're going to fix the system when we know how cruel it is. I was on the way you sell a book in America is you do these, you talk TV and talk radio. And I was on a talk radio show, a syndicated show, with a guy named Mike Rosen, a very nice guy. But he's kind of a mini Rush Limbaugh. He's a conservative, kind of angry conservative guy. And nice guy, though. And I went on his show. And here's, you know, I had written this book saying we ought to provide health care for everybody. And if you go around the world, you can find ways to do it. And he said to me, he said, Mr. Reed, 85% of the people in America are happy with their health care arrangements. Why do you want to mess up everything for the 15%? Well, in the first place, 15% is 40 million people. I mean, we ought to provide health care for 40 million people. But I didn't have a very good answer for this. I didn't see this question coming. And about 15 minutes into this program, one of his listeners calls up. And he says, hey, Mike, I heard what you asked this guy. Why do you want to mess up everything for the 15%? And he says, you know, in Montgomery, Alabama, 85% of the people could ride on the front of the bus. So why did we mess everything up for the 15%? And that's exactly it. When we realize that what we're doing is wrong, Americans will fix it. And so I'm sure, I'm confident that we're going to fix it. I think the 2020 election is going to be a major step towards finally getting everybody health care in America.
And from the state level, Colorado has kind of been front and center on trying to do some things with universal health care. And I know that you've been part of that movement. It didn't get through last time. What do you think the mistakes were, or why didn't it pass, and what does it need to do to get over the hump, in your opinion?
In Colorado, we got a measure on the ballot that would have created basically a state-run Medicare, a state-run single-payer plan. You paid for it through state taxes, and it would have covered everybody in Colorado. It was good insurance. The tax would have been cheaper than your health insurance premium. Unlike the narrow networks of the insurance companies, it covered every doctor, every hospital, every chiropractor, every PT. It let the patient make the choice. It was a good plan. And here's what happened. The insurance companies saw this and they were terrified because under our plan, people could buy private insurance or they could use the Colorado plan. Everybody would have used the Colorado plan because it was cheaper and it had more choice. And so the insurance companies and Big Pharma spent $8 million to defeat our plan. And we lost. We got creamed at the polls. The plan didn't go anywhere. And out of that, the people in Colorado who want universal health care stepped back and we're now going at it in smaller ways. So our legislature last year passed a plan that allows Colorado employers and the state to import medicine from drugs from Canada. That'll save money. We set up a reinsurance plan, which will help the insurance companies pay for really high bills, and that should cut premiums. And we set up a committee to discuss, a blue ribbon commission, to figure out the cheapest way to provide health care for everybody in Colorado. I'm one of the commissioners on that commission. And we are required to make a recommendation to the legislature, and then the legislature theoretically will act on it. So, yeah, Colorado is really moving ahead on this issue of getting health care for everybody. I think it may be that we and other states, Oregon, Washington, are also on this case. Michigan is looking at it pretty hard. I think we may all sit back and wait to see what happens on a national basis after the 2020 election. If it looks like there's going to be movement on the federal level, then the states will sit back. And if nothing is happening on the federal level, then our states will move ahead and try to get something done.
So what's the hardest lesson you have learned over your illustrious career?
The hardest lesson I've learned is convincing people that what they believe to be true is wrong. You need facts, you need stories. I've always thought as a reporter, part of my job was to say to people, hey, maybe the sky's not blue. You know, maybe what you believe, maybe the moon is not made of green cheese. For example, there's this very common statistic in America that Japan has a high rate of suicide, and particularly among students. And as a matter of fact, if you look at the numbers, rates of suicide in Japan are about the same for students, for young people, as they are in America, and they're lower for older people. And I wrote that story 20 times when I was a reporter in Japan, and people just don't buy it. And the same for healthcare. What I've written over and over is if you provide healthcare for everybody, if you cover everybody, you spend less than a fragmented system like ours that leaves 30 million people uninsured. And people say, but that's not logical. You mean I'm going to cover more people but spend less? Yes, the answer is true. Certainly, you look at any of the 15 countries in my book. They cover everybody. On average, they spend half as much as we do for better outcomes. But it's hard to get people to overcome what somehow or other they came to believe is true. So that's the hardest part is convincing people that their prejudices have led them astray.
You know, you've had just an amazing career and seen so much of the world in many different ways. When you look back on it, what time or what were you working on that was the most fun and you just felt like all cylinders were firing and you were just in your groove?
In 1980, I covered the presidential election. I first covered Ted Kennedy ran against Jimmy Carter for the Democratic nomination. And then in the fall, I covered Ronald Reagan. And it was just a great election. I wrote on the first day of that campaign, I wrote in my diary, Reagan won the Republican nomination, but the American people would never elect a washed-up B-movie actor to be our president. It's hopeless. And what was it? 4 months later, in November, the campaign plane was flying out to California so Ron and Nancy could vote. And I wrote in my diary, he's going to be a good president, because he convinced me, just like he convinced the American people, that he was the leader we needed right at that time. So that was, I think, really fun. And then when I went to Japan, as a foreign correspondent in 1989. Japan's economy was booming. The Japanese bought Rockefeller Center. They bought Pebble Beach. They bought 7-Eleven and Firestone Tires. And a lot of Americans were afraid that Japan was going to take over and become number one and beat us at what we were good at. And then Japan went into recession. And it was really interesting to watch this total reversal of that booming economy as they went into a 10-year recession. So that was a very interesting story. And, you know, we feel in the United States that when economic times are bad, well, a lot of people resort to crime. The crime goes up. In Japan, they have very little crime anyway. And when the economy went to hell, no increase in crime, zero. And I asked the head of their FBI, I asked the head of their police force, do you think crime rates are going to go up now that the economy is sour? And he said to me, well, why would that be? Why? I don't get it. In other words, you know, it just didn't happen in that country because they have such a strong social commitment not to commit crimes, to get along with each other. So I thought that was a great story. And then more or less by accident, I happened on to writing this book about how other countries manage to provide health care for everybody. And one of the ways you make money on books these days, Steve, is you go out and give lectures about it, and they pay you to give a lecture. And I've lectured all over the country on healthcare and how we could fix our healthcare system. And I find myself making the moral argument that a decent country has a moral obligation to provide healthcare for anybody who needs it. And that's been fabulous. I've just really enjoyed that work. I mean, I haven't gotten there. Things are actually worse than they were 2 years ago in terms of healthcare in America. But I've really enjoyed the work. And this is what's really surprising to me. People come up to me and say, thank you for your work. No, I'm just doing my job. I'm trying to sell books here. But they're thanking me. So that's, you know, the work on healthcare has been quite rewarding. And as I say, I'm optimistic. I think we're going to get something done. So that would be quite nice.
That's great. So what message do you want to give your grandkids that will help them throughout their lives?
Work hard. I believe in our country and our system. If you, you know, if you're diligent, if you work hard, if you work honestly, you find some line of work you really like and put your all into it, you're going to do fine. You're going to do well in your own life and help others. So I still believe strongly in applying yourself, using your skills, and work hard at it. Don't goof off. My late wife always used to say, sometimes it's okay to do a C job. You know, sometimes you don't have to do your best. I don't believe that. I think whatever you do, work or play, do an A job, do your best, work hard at it, and you'll be pleased with the result.
Now, this may seem redundant that I just asked you this, but at this point in the interviews, we usually ask all our guests, what's a pearl of wisdom that you can leave us with? So other than what you just said, what's a pearl of wisdom that you can leave our listeners with today?
You know, personal freedom is the most important value for Americans. I believe that very strongly. So let's all work to see to it that we're a country that cares for each other and protects our individual liberties. That's really crucial to me.
Yeah. Well, TR, thank you so much for taking the time with us today. I look back over your life and all that you've accomplished and all that you've done, and it's just very impressive. And it seems like it was a good run. And so not that you're done yet by any means, but I just want to commend you for taking the time. I know you're very busy and you have a lot of people asking you for favors. So I appreciate this, and I really enjoyed talking with you today.
Well, Steve, I'm a big fan of Profiles and Leadership, so it's an honor for me to be on it. Thanks for putting me on your podcast. I'm grateful.
Thanks so much, and have a good rest of your day, and enjoy the rest of that Colorado summer.
Yeah, I'm going to. Thanks, Steve.
Okay, take care. Yeah. Thank you for tuning in to another episode of Profiles and Leadership. To hear the entire series of interviews, search iTunes Podcasts for Profiles in Leadership with Steve Anderson. To view videos of many of my interviews, search YouTube for Profiles in Leadership with Steve Anderson. You can also visit my website, which is orange.coaching.com, and that's orange, the word, .coaching.com, and go to the Media Center, where all episodes of the video and podcast episodes are available.